taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans. Welcome to the Constitution Study. This is where we read and study the Constitution. Teach, rise, and generation be free. I want to thank everybody that's been sending in questions. Several of you have asked for those questions to be answered on the radio, so I am putting together a Q&A segment that I will be doing hopefully in the near future. I hope everybody is having a good time preparing for Thanksgiving. But today I want to talk to parents. See, everybody here either is a parent or has parents. And a question that frequently comes up is parents' rights. Now, we've seen this a lot lately in talking about mask and vaccine mandates, and do parents have the right to have a say in how their children are treated in school, about their medical decisions. We see it in, especially in Loudoun, Virginia, where the question is, do the parents have the authority to control their children's education, to have a say in what they are and are not taught? And in doing this, I came across an interesting court case out of the Second Circuit back in the 1970s.
With the recent approval of the Pfizer vaccine for 5 to 11-year-olds, many are wondering when their recommendations to vaccinate will become a mandate. Do governments have the legal authority to intervene in a family decision? And if so, under what conditions? Now, one opinion comes from a case out of the Second Circuit in the 1970s. Now, understanding the limits of the coercive power of government over families will be important if we wish to remain free. Parents are responsible for the health and welfare of their children. This fundamental truth should be at the bedrock of family law in America. However, not everyone sees things that way. In 1977, the United States Court of Appeals Second Circuit confirmed that children are not the property of the state, except in extreme circumstances. The name of this case is Duquesne versus Sugarman. Let's start with the circumstances that led to the case. In December 1969, Pauline Perez had two minor children, Danny, age 7, and Marisol, age 6 months. Now, on September 16th, Ms. Perez decided she needed to seek medical attention for her emotional problems. Expecting to be treated as an outpatient, Ms. Perez left her two children with a neighbor. Instead, Ms. Perez was admitted to Bellevue Hospital, where she remained for the next 6 days. The neighbor contacted police, informing them that she could only take care of Ms. Perez's children for the night, as she was about to give birth to her own child. But the police relayed this to Welfare Center, and they contacted New York City's Bureau of Child Welfare, or BCW. Now, on December 17th, the BCW representative visited Ms. Perez in the hospital and asked her to sign a form granting consent to the Bureau to take custody of her children. The Bureau rep told Ms. Perez that she would not lose any parental rights, and as soon as she was released from the hospital, her children would be returned. However, Ms. Perez refused to grant her consent that BCW take custody of her children. The BCW employee informed his supervisor, James Prinsler, of Ms. Perez's refusal to consent. Prinsler advised the caseworker that consent was not necessary at that point. The same day, BCW assumed custody of Ms. Perez's children, placing Danny in St. Joseph's Home for Children and Marisol in the New York Foundling Hospital. Records from both BCW and the two institutions indicate that the emergency placement was requested by BCW because the children's mother was in the hospital. No mention was made that the mother had not given consent and that BCW had not gotten a court order to take custody of the children. This appeared to be in accordance with city policies at the time. Now, on December 22, 1969, Ms. Perez was released from Bellevue Hospital and immediately contacted a BCW caseworker demanding the return of her children. Her children, however, were not returned by BCW. Several days later, Ms. Perez voluntarily returned to the hospital until February 1970. Upon her release, Ms. Perez once again contacted BCW for the return of her children. Once again, her request was rejected. On January 22, 1970, a deputy commissioner authorized St. Joseph's to admit Danny into foster care because of the mental illness of the person caring for the child. Then on March 2, a similar authorization was sent to Foundling Hospital for Marisol. This means that the children were no longer in emergency temporary placement, but in long-term and possibly permanent care. On April 29th, the psychiatrist treating Ms. Perez recommended the children be returned to her one at a time. The BCW reported this recommendation to the two child care institutions, but they objected and the children were not returned. For months, Ms. Perez repeatedly requested the return of her children, all of which were denied. During this time, the children were not even allowed to visit each other. Then in October 1971, Ms. Perez found that Marisol had been transferred to a foster home without her knowledge. All of Ms. Perez's complaints to various authorities that she never signed any papers were apparently ignored. Now, records show that at least as of November 10, 1971, BCW, St. Joseph's, and the Foundling Hospital were aware that Ms. Perez never signed any consent or commitment papers. Apparently, they discussed the absence of consent but decided to take no action unless Ms. Perez initiated legal proceedings. Now, records also revealed that, quote, "Since obtaining Pauline's signature at this point seemed an impossibility, they agreed not to attempt it." Now, on February 22, 1972, 27 months after her family had been separated, Ms. Perez filed a petition in the New York Supreme Court seeking a writ of habeas corpus, or produce the body. Now, only after Ms. Perez filed her petition did BCW and the two childcare facilities file a neglect action against her. These two actions were combined and heard in family court, which denied Ms. Perez's petition for habeas corpus and found Ms. Perez guilty of neglect. The appellate division reversed the family court's decision, finding that the initial removal and continued detention of the children was done in violation of state law due to a lack of Ms. Perez's consent or a court order. Furthermore, the appellate court reversed the family court's finding of neglect because Ms. Perez was denied the opportunity to present evidence in her favor. Now, this is where the case goes to the Second Circuit. The threshold inquiry is whether the evidence established that appellants have been deprived of a constitutional right. They assert that the removal and detention of the children with neither parental consent nor court authorization, and in the face of the mother's repeated request for their return, deprived them of their right to live together as a family without due process of law. The crux of the claim is the appellees could not constitutionally refuse to return the children to their mother's custody without providing an opportunity to be heard at a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner. Now, can the state take custody of your children without your consent or a court order? See, that was the question the Second Circuit was dealing with. As the court stated, "It is beyond peradventure that freedom of personal choice in matters of family life is one of the liberties protected by the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment." So what is this Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment? Well, it states, "Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law." As the court points out, the liberty to live as one sees fit without governmental interference can only be abridged legally by due process of law, which the Free Legal Dictionary defines as an established course for judicial proceedings or other governmental activities designed to safeguard the legal rights of the individual. Some people say the process is the punishment. However, when it comes to the Constitution and laws of the United States and of the several states, the process must protect the rights of the individual. As the Second Circuit noted in their opinion, "Here we are concerned with the most essential and basic aspect of family privacy, the right of the family to remain together without the coercive interference of the awesome power of the state. This right to the preservation of family integrity encompasses the reciprocal right of both parents and children. It is the interest of the parent in the companionship, care, custody, and management of his or her children, and of the children in not being dislocated from the emotional attachments that derive from the intimacy of daily association with the parent. The mutual interest in interdependence relationship has received consistent support in the cases of the Supreme Court." The court pointed out that the most basic aspect of family life is the right of a family to remain together without the interference of government. The Second Circuit then gets to what I believe is the crux of the matter. The trial court concluded that the initial custody in December 1969 was clearly proper since the facts show an emergency situation with the mother in the psychiatric ward of Bellevue Hospital and no one to care for the children. We agree that the evidence establishes that the taking of the children was justified at the outset by an emergency. As such, as a matter of constitutional law, the initial removal of the children without parental consent or a prior court order was permissible. However, in those extraordinary situations where deprivation of a protected interest is permitted without prior process, the constitutional requirements of notice and opportunity to be heard are not eliminated, but merely postponed. Was BCW legally authorized to take Ms. Perez's children into custody? Since there was no one to take care of them, the answer is yes. What we have here is what the law calls an exigent circumstance, requiring immediate action, pressing, and urgent need. See the synonym as urgent. Since the mother was hospitalized, there was an urgent need to find someone to care for these children. The mother had not given her consent to the BCW, and there was not enough time to get a court order. So BCW took the children into custody and placed them in appropriate child care facilities. At that point, BCW had acted within the law, but then things went off the rails. When Ms. Perez was out of the hospital and contacted BCW for the return of her children, she was denied. BCW relied on a previous case, Boone v. Wyman, which challenged a New York social services law that provided that once a child was remanded or committed to an authorized agency, the parent was not entitled to custody without the consent of the authority or a court order. There was one significant difference between Boone case and Perez's. So in the Boone case, Ms. Boone had granted her consent that a state agency take custody of her children. In Ms. Perez's case, not only did the BCW not have her consent to take her children into custody, they did not even attempt to obtain a court order until 3 years after their initial emergency action. By denying Ms. Perez custody of her children, even denying her the chance to challenge BCW in a competent court, BCW had denied her the liberty to live with her family without due process of law. Now, what does this 1970s custody battle have to do with possible vaccine mandates? The answer comes from the concluding paragraph of the court's opinion. If a state were to attempt to force the breakup of a natural family over the objections of the parents and their children without some showing of unfitness and for the sole reason that to do so was thought to be in the child's best interest, I should have little doubt that the state would have intruded impermissibly on the private realm of family life which the state cannot enter. Before the state is legally allowed to intrude into the private realm of the family, there must be some showing of unfitness. In other words, the state must show actual harm to the child, not merely what the state believes is in the child's best interest. To claim the authority to require a vaccine, the state must show that the child is in real physical danger from the disease and that the vaccine is the only viable remedy. A simple look at the CDC's own data shows neither statement to be true. While the 5 to 11 age group makes up 8.7% of the U.S. population and accounts for 5.6% of the cases, 0% of the deaths, only 192 deaths total, have occurred among this group. As we see governments at all levels claiming the authority to tell us how to live our lives, it becomes more and more important that everyday Americans not only know their rights, but the laws that protect them. So if your school starts demanding that your child receive a COVID vaccination, point them to the Perez and Boone cases. Point out that without a court order, any attempt to vaccinate your child without your consent is battery, and that you would seek prosecution to the fullest extent of the law, along with civil damages. As John Jay said, by knowing their rights, they will sooner perceive when they are violated and be the better prepared to defend and assert them. To be forewarned is to be forearmed. If we are to fight for our rights and liberty, we must be armed with both the truth and the law. Hopefully, this episode has helped you protect not only your rights, but also the rights of your children.
And really, isn't that what this is all about? Isn't about protecting not only our rights, but the rights of our children? Now, okay, not all of us have children. Not all of us have are as concerned about rights. But ultimately, that's really where this, for me, where this boils down to. What point does the government have? At what point does the government have the authority to tell us to do what they think is best for us? Again, it's one thing for you to decide for yourself. Do you want to take the vaccine or not? Do you want to go someplace where people are unvaccinated or not? Do you want to let unvaccinated people into your home? But that's a private decision. At what point did we give government the authority to say, we know better than you do, we're going to force you, we're going to mandate this? And the answer is never. We never authorize this. And since, according to the Declaration, the only just power government has comes from our consent, if we did not consent to this, I don't mean individually, I mean as a group, well, then this is not a just power. This is an unjust power. This is repugnant to the Constitution. So these orders, these mandates, these recommendations with punishment, well, they're all void. They're repugnant to the Constitution. They're void. I get a lot of questions about what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? And I'm always going to start with understanding that government can bully you. Government can intimidate you. But government cannot make you. Ultimately, you must decide how much you'll put up with. You must decide when you will say, uncle. All you have to do is say no one more time than they say yes, and you win. So understanding this case, and why do I bring up this case? This case from the 1970s. Well, part of it is I was alive. I was living in New York City during this case. So I wasn't aware of it. I was a child at the time, but it struck a chord with me. I've lived in New York City. I've been to Bellevue Hospital. I know the places they're talking about. And I've also heard the stories and I've read the articles of parents who are terrified of any sort of child welfare services, where they see the agents of these departments wielding unimaginable power, claiming the authority to simply walk into your home and take your children because they don't like the way you're treating them. Now, I'm sure the vast majority of these case agents are honest, good people. They truly want what is best for the child. They are not trying to abuse their authority. They're not trying to impose their will on others. The vast majority, all right? If you're a caseworker, I'm not pointing you out and trying to paint with too broad a brush. But there are those, there will always be those who abuse the powers they have to their own end. Now, interestingly, I didn't find anything in the opinion of the court as to why BCW and the two child care facilities refused to return the children. Doesn't say. You know, did they think that that she was a bad mother, that she was incompetent? Sure, they filed for neglect, but only 3 years later. Seemed to me more like a CYA than an actual consideration of unfitness. So I don't think we'll ever know why they did what they did. But as I see government officials, supposed public servants, at all levels of government, federal, state, and local, claiming that they have the authority to tell you how to raise your children, what they must be taught, where they must be sent to school, what medications they must have. I'm reminded of this poor mother who is in a difficult situation. The situation of apparently a single mother, no one else to take care of the children, and needing mental health, needing hospitalization. You know, part of me feels she's between a rock and a hard place. If she knows she needs attention for her emotional problems, you don't want her taking those out on her children. But we don't want the children left alone. They need supervision as well. And again, not knowing any of the details of Ms. Perez's life, I'm only dealing with the legal aspects that are there. which brings to mind a couple of things from this standpoint. You know, I do not agree with the statement it takes a village to raise a child. It takes parents to raise a child. But sometimes parents need help. I mean, we raised our daughter. Our daughter's in her 20s now. My wife and I raised our daughter. I think we did a pretty good job of it. People tell me we did a pretty good job of it. But I also remember times when we had to be away for days. Well, guess what? My father and my stepmother were around to take care of our daughter. One time, my wife's mother took care of our daughter. We had the opportunity. We had friends that were prepared to take care of our daughter if we needed it. And we had made provisions beforehand. We had thought about that. We had talked with people and said, listen, if anything happens, would you take care of our daughter? We actually had, you may call it defense in layers. We had several people. We had my father and stepmother. We had Pamela's mother. We had two different sets of friends, two different couples that we had talked to because we recognized their willingness to raise our daughter in a way we thought was appropriate. Now, whether it was a short-term issue or a long-term issue, we had made provision. And I think we were wise to do that, which makes me wonder, are you making provision for your children should something drastic happen? Maybe it's a medical condition. Maybe it's a death in the family. Maybe it's just something crazy happens. You never know. You prepare for the worst, you hope for the best. But have you thought about that? Have you taken the time to talk to somebody and say, listen, if this were to happen, if for some reason I couldn't take care of my child or children for a period of time, would you be willing to do so? Would you do that in a way that I would agree with? And then the flip side of that is, would you be willing to do that? I asked myself, in fact, I was just this morning as I was out on my porch reading and praying, I'm like, you know, I can't say that I've ever really had the situation where someone asked me to take care of their child for a significant period of time. Oh, sure. You know, I've had friends that, you know, hey, can you, you know, watch their kids while they're off doing something? You know, maybe it's I had one friend, he wanted, you know, his kids were home. He and his wife were off for a long weekend. The oldest was old enough to care for the children, but he still said, hey, Paul, would you just check in, make sure everything's okay? And I was more than happy to. But I realized, you know, would I be willing to foster a child in need? Would I be willing to take in someone from our church or from our neighborhood, a child that needed assistance? Now, I think I would, you know, my wife has a medical condition. She's in a wheelchair. It would be harder on her, but I think I would do that. This story just got me thinking of why do we keep running to government to take care of each other? See, if I found that somebody in our town or in our neighborhood or in our church, if they had a problem and they needed someone to take care of their children for a day, for a week, for a month, for a year, I would hope they would come and ask for help before they ran to government. I know we've all been trained that government, we have government programs to do this, but is that the best answer? I'm not saying government programs, I'm not saying the people in there aren't good people. I'm saying I'm not sure the best answer is to be dependent on government to expect government to take care of the orphan, whether it be a true orphan situation or just a temporary situation. I don't think government's the best to take care of the poor, the widow, the orphan, the sick. I don't. I think evidence shows they're not very good at it. But it means if we're going to be willing to do this, we really need to make preparation for this. We need to let other people know that, yes, in a situation, we will step up and help. Here's what we can do. Here's what we're willing to do. Hey, by the way, if there's a situation, would you be willing to help? I think if we try to take care of each other, rather than expecting government to do it for us, we'll have fewer people that end up in the situation of Ms. Perez, where she's got one neighbor to take care of her children, and that neighbor can only do so for a short period of time. Then her only option was government. So maybe take some time, think about that as we approach the Thanksgiving holiday, to give thanks for our healthy children, to give thanks that we haven't yet needed government assistance, but also to be willing to help others. To be willing to help ourselves and then to help our neighbors. And that by doing so, we become less dependent on government and we give government less control over our lives. Now, I have to take a break, but I want to please send you over to constitutionstudy.com so you can find everything I'm doing at the Constitution Study. I am working on an online Constitution Study for 2022. You can find out more at constitutionstudy.com/study. Find out what I'll be doing. Sign up. I'm still working on the schedule, so you'll get input onto when I might have these events. So you can find out more there. I'm working on some other events as well, so you can always please ask a question. As I said, I'm putting together a Q&A segment for this program, and I'd like to do it regularly, but I need questions to answer. So go to constitutionstudy.com, look at the Ask a Question. There's a little checkbox that says answer it on the America Out Loud radio, talk radio network, and I'll be more than happy to do so here. Also, I want you to send you over to healthycell.com. Now, I don't know about you, but life seems to be crazy, and I don't think we know where our food comes from, and I don't think we always know what's in our food. So many of us take vitamin supplements. My wife has me taking supplements. She's had me taking supplements for years. Well, Healthy Cell's kind of reinvented the vitamin. It hasn't changed since the 1930s. Now Healthy Cell comes along. Don't take a fistful of pills. Have this little gel. You can mix it in your food or your drink or just drink it right out of the pouch. They have different formulas based on what you need. Now, sometimes maybe what we need is we need a boost to the immune system. You know, you got COVID and we're going to be entering into flu season and many of us are going to be indoors more. We're going to have more opportunity. Try Healthy Cells Immune Super Boost. It gives your immune system the support it needs in a simple travel-ready gel pack. And as an America Out Loud listener, you will get 20% off your first order. Just use the code OUTLOUD at checkout. So try any of their formulas, sign up for a subscription, but be sure to use OUTLOUD at checkout to get 20% off your very first order.
Well, my fellow Americans, how did you feel watching footage on the news of domestic terrorists looting our stores and burning our cities down? You were probably disgusted and angry as much as I was. It's disturbing what's going on. Well, you'd be shocked to know that your shopping habits are supporting these extremists. Companies like Amazon, Nike, Disney, FedEx, it's an endless list. And they've been supporting these radical groups. Let's stop supporting companies that fund these extremist groups. We can all do our part. Visit shoptotheright.com and you'll find businesses in a nationwide database and companies that are aligned with our American values. Visit shoptotheright.com and let's all make a difference.
Each of us is born with 30 trillion cells that make us. These cells determine how we feel, perform, sleep, focus, and how long we live. And to live our best life, all we have to do is feed our cells. But most food and supplements don't reach our cells, keeping us from reaching our full potential. Make every cell count with Healthy Cell. Founded with a mission to empower people to take control of their own health at the most fundamental level, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, world-renowned cell researcher and medical doctor, created supplements that work at the cellular level to boost immune health, sleep better, focus deeper, and stay younger longer. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any product. And that's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
AmericaOutloud.com. Simply put, we're patriots who believe in Ronald Reagan's vision of a shining city on a hill. From sea to shining sea, you can listen in on iHeartRadio. Our free apps are on Apple, Android, or Alexa, or our world-class media player. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution study. Here we read and study the Constitution. We teach the American people to be free. This generation, the next generation, the next generation after that. And based on today, we're talking about this simple question. Does government know best? Does government have the authority to tell you how to live your life? Whether that is as a parent, which we dealt with in the first half, or just as our lives. See, I found this article talking about the American Medical Association pushing critical race theory material in a health equity guide. Yeah, advancing health equity. Now, I don't know about you. When I go to the doctor, I'm really hoping the only reason they care about my race is for a medical reason. They're not worried about, well, you know, gee, Paul, you're a white man, so you've had much better health care than everybody, so we have to degrade your health care. So it'd be equity. So here you have a supposedly medical association. I'm sorry, the American Medical Association has shown themselves to be a political organization, at least now. They may have started as a medical organization. They are not. See, they have in this 55-page document, they say they have things like a list of words not to say. So this is the things they don't want the doctors to say. And they want to provide things like equity-focused alternatives. And they want to criticize things like meritocracy, individualism, and the free market. This is supposedly a medical document. This is supposed to be health document? No, it's not. This is a racist political document. Yes, it is. It's racist. Because you're telling doctors to deal with their patients differently based on race. See, if you get rid of individualism, this is a classic example. So we've had all this push. You have Fauci saying everybody must be vaccinated regardless of their individual medical condition. See, if you've already had COVID and you have natural immunity, doesn't matter. See, that's individualism. We can't have that. The herd, everybody must get this. Free market. Oh, no, you can't be allowed to get the medical treatment that you and your doctor think are best. You can't go out on the free market and get it. It must be dictated by government. But you see, this is being sent to doctors. And let me ask you, how many doctors are going to read this going, oh, yeah, we can't do that. We can't talk about things like meritocracy and individualism and free market. Oh, no, we have to do whatever the CDC tells us to do. That's right, Mr. Bill. We have to do whatever the CDC tells us to do. We don't care that it's going to kill you. We just have to do it. So that's what happens when you let politics influence every part of your life. CRT is a political movement. CRT is a racist political movement. And now, the American Medical Association, which a lot of people apparently still look up to for medical advice, seems more interested in promoting a racist political theory than in actually talking about medical health. As I said, now there are certain diseases that impact races differently. I am a white man. My odds of getting sickle cell anemia are just about zero. My friend Joe, who is a black man, has a much greater risk of having sickle cell anemia than I ever will. That's just the nature of the beast. And that is the extent of the impact I want race to have on medical decisions. And you know what? I am tired of playing, patty cake with these politicians with medical degrees and with these racists that are trying to set policy. So I've told you, my wife, we've had to find a new neurologist for her because her old neurologist won't see her anymore because he doesn't believe in individualism. He believes everybody has to have the vaccine. Everybody's got to have the vaccine. The fact that she is at risk for things like, blood clots. She already has a suppressed immune system. No, he doesn't care about that. No. She's got to get the vaccine. So we're finding it. And we've had a hard time. It's amazing. We're in Middle Tennessee, so most of the doctors are part of the Vanderbilt system, and they're pumping up these quote-unquote vaccines, which is not a vaccine. It's two of them are gene therapy, I should say. The mRNA is not a vaccine. It's gene therapy. So we've spent a long time. We're still looking. We're still looking for a neurologist that believes in individualism, believes in a free market, believes that patients have rights, and that doesn't simply bow to whatever Lord Fauci or the CDC or the FDA or whatever governmental agency pushes on them. Because no, government doesn't know best. In fact, pretty much test shows me that government knows worst. I mean, just imagine you're a parent, you take your child to a pediatrician and they're like, no, I can't treat them individually. Sure, you need something specialized for your child, but you know what? You can't go out to the free market to get it. No. We're going to treat your child based on the color of their skin. I don't know about you, but that disturbs me. And that's not a doctor I will deal with. I don't care. I will find another doctor. And parents, let me ask you, are you prepared to turn your infants into guinea pigs? See, Moderna is testing their mRNA shot on infants nationwide. Wow. Now, again, I refuse to take any of these shots because I will not be a medical experiment for a disease I have a 99.5% chance of surviving. An infant has a statistically 0% chance of dying from COVID. But Moderna has launched a large-scale test of the COVID jab on children from infants to 6 months old. What are future Americans going to say about us that we were willing to experiment on our children? You know, it was one thing when Joseph Mengele forced experimentation on children. What happens when we find the people voluntarily allowed our children to be experimented on? And why? Why does Moderna want to run this test? Well, according to them, to Moderna, the primary purpose is to test the safety and effectiveness of the vaccine in protecting children from getting sick if they come in contact with SARS-CoV-2 virus, the virus that causes COVID-19. Okay. Why are you going to risk the health of children to test them from a disease they have a statistically zero chance of dying from? I'm not making these numbers up. I'm looking at the CDC's own website, which states quite clearly that between 0 and age 4, right? But 0 and 4, that represents roughly 6% of the entire U.S. population. But only 2.6% of the cases, just under a million cases, actually are children age 0 to 4. But it's only 295 deaths, period. So if you look at that, that is 0.03% of the children who actually got COVID-19 died from COVID-19. So if 0 to 4 represents 6% of the population, that's roughly 20 million children, 0 to 6. I'm sorry, 0 to 4. And only 1 million have been diagnosed with the disease. I don't even want to say they caught the disease, because more and more, what do we see? We see the inflation of case numbers. But let's take their numbers, right? We're working right off of their numbers. 2.6%, or roughly a million of the almost 20 million, approximately 20 million children aged 0 to 4. 295 have died. Now, for those 295 families, that is terrible. And I do feel for them. I'm not minimizing the pain to an individual family. But it makes me wonder, with all the reports of problems with this vaccine, especially in younger people, heart problems, blood clot problems, why are we experimenting on our children for something that is extremely rare? They die from it. Why? Now, I'm sure I can come up with a bunch of Machiavellian reasons why they would want to do this, but I think it's simply a question you need to ask. Excuse me, why do you want to experiment on my child? Now, if you're a parent and you want to experiment on your child, I suppose. I mean, we just talked about, until we can prove harm, until we can show that these vaccines are a imminent danger to these infants, I suppose. But as a parent, I can't imagine allowing my child to be experimented on for something they have, almost no chance of dying from. It's like testing a vaccine for chickenpox. The odds of my child dying from chickenpox is extremely small. In fact, I remember being a small child, if somebody in the neighborhood got chickenpox, all the moms sent the kids to play with them because they wanted them to get chickenpox to get the natural immunity. But this disturbs me. This truly disturbs, this truly, what does it say about our society? It's one thing to say, what does it say about Moderna that they wish to experiment on children? They want to sell vaccines. Fine. What does it say about the American people? What percentage of parents are willing to have their children experimented on? What does it say about American society that we're willing to potentially sacrifice our children to make ourselves feel better? To make ourselves feel safer, not be safer, feel safer. There's plenty of evidence that the vaccines are not nearly as effective as they told us they were, that you can still get COVID with the vaccine. You can still transmit COVID with the vaccine. But as a people, we're willing to experiment on our children. Now, I have been following the story of the FBI and the school board meetings, and the fact that they're tagging information, and Fauci sent out a memo, the Attorney General sent out a memo, and how the it was based on a lie from a letter from the National Association of School Boards, or National School Board Association, something like that, claiming there was a rise in threats of violence when they haven't shown any. There was a little good news. So the FBI director told former agents that the Bureau won't be sending people to attend school board meetings. See, FBI Director Christopher Wray made it clear during a speech that FBI agents would not be attending school board meetings. Good. Good. He said the Bureau would stay in its own lane. Good. See, this is a good thing. And as much as we vilify and decry the actions of government, when somebody in government does the right thing, we should acknowledge it. He said it. As long as he holds to that, that's good. You see, there's nothing in the Constitution that delegates the United States the authority to oversee education, threats of violence against individuals? None. So the fact that the Attorney General and President Biden seems to just ignore that and they want to stick their little FBI fingers wherever they can, at least the director said he won't. Now, we'll see how long that lasts. Will he get pressure from the AG? Will he get pressure from Biden? Will he fold? Will he be removed? We don't know. But we got to take the good news where we can find it. But we got to go back. See, I wanted to throw a little good news in because, well, I got some more bad news for you. So here's the bad news. The good news is the FBI says, no, we're not going to be attending school board meetings, even though they're still tagging school board, I guess, upstarts. But you see, the National Counselors of Teachers of English has revised their standards for educators. See, this is about teaching English. So you're talking about your English teacher, not your history teacher, not your social teacher, your English teacher. And the English teachers are going to be trained in the issues of justice, equity, and diversity to become a central part of English teaching standards. You see, this methodology, this concept that experts know best is infiltrated every part of the education system. It's why we wouldn't send our daughter to government school. You see, because in teaching about bigotry, discrimination, oppression, divisiveness, and racism, they are teaching our children to be bigots, to discriminate, to be oppressive, to be divisive, and to be racists. And just when you thought it was bad enough in social studies class, what happens when it comes to English class? Now, if it comes to English class, why not math? Tell me, are you setting your standards based on the National Council of Teachers of English? Do you know what influence the National Council of Teachers of English has on your school board and your school curriculum? Now, here's my point. There are many books and stories that can be used to teach without instilling racism. I mean, the classic is Uncle Tom's Cabin. But you also look at Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn. These are stories where racism and its effects are part of the story. And reading them and understanding them and understanding their place in our history, well, that's a good thing. But you see, when I see a National Council of Teachers of English saying they want to train school teachers in anti-racism, what are they teaching them? You see, the group defines racism, the council defines racism as the, quote, systematic mistreatment and disenfranchisement of people of color who currently and historically possess less power and privilege than white Americans. Notice how racism only goes one way. Racism only deals they've possessed less power. Interesting. I've worked for many people of color. I don't remember them having less power than I do. The council goes on, racism and other forms of discrimination continue to be part of American society, continue to affect all students and their education. Apparently, they don't believe Dr. Martin Luther King. See, Dr. Martin Luther King didn't want his children judged by the color of their skin. He wanted them judged by meritocracy, by their individualism, by the content of their character. But now we have this racism in the disguise of anti-racism infiltrating even more parts of our government-run school. So let me ask you, does government know best? Are there racists out there? Absolutely. There always have been. There always will be. In fact, I think in many ways in the last, 15, 20 years, racism has been on the rise in America. Because now, more than ever, people are being judged by the color of their skin. But it's this weird, twisted racism because it's this racism aligned with a progressive Marxist view of the world. I mean, how else could you explain black candidates being referred to as white supremacists? Because they don't toe a specific political party's line. Is that what you want your children taught? And if that's not what you want your children taught, what provision are you making to keep them from being taught that? Not everybody has the opportunity. Not everybody can send their children to private school. Not everybody can homeschool their children. But we need to make provisions. We need to recognize what is being put in these young skulls and figure out how we're going to deal with that. Because think about it. You know, there's an old saying, be kind to your kids, they will choose your nursing home. What happens when you have children that have been steeped in bigotry and racism deciding America's future? If your children from age 5 to age 20 are told that they're racist because of the color of their skin, that they can't get ahead because of the color of their skin, that they shouldn't, you know, they don't have to work because they're not going to get ahead because of the color of their skin. What happens when they're choosing our elected leaders? What happens when they become our elected leaders? What happens to the future of America when we reinstill racism in our country? Now, before we go, I have one other story, and it is a bit about families and stuff, but, you know, we're coming up to Thanksgiving season. Thanksgiving is tomorrow, and I don't know about you, I love getting together with family and friends, and sure, I love the meal. I cook the meal, so it's a big deal, but I read this article. It was in the New American, and it truly disturbed me. See, one poll conducted a survey of 2,000 U.S. Residents early in November. And nearly 7 in 10 respondents said they cannot go home for the holidays without getting vaccinated first. And of the 65% who are fully vaccinated, 6 in 10 have reportedly cut off family members who refuse to get vaccinated. We now have families segregating based on this quote-unquote vaccine. Think of the division that has been placed in this country just in the last year on the question of being vaccinated. 72% of the vaccinated respondents don't think they could ever get some of these family members to understand the importance of the vaccine. We have a divide. And we have a divide over a treatment, I can't even call it a vaccine, for a disease with an extremely low death rate for the vast majority of people. Again, you go to the CDC data. Under 65, under 50, your odds of dying are under 4%. Yes, as you get older, your odds go up, but you're also dealing with other health situations. Now, I understand if you have a family member that for whom they have comorbidities, for whom the COVID would be a serious threat, we want to take proper precautions. But see, that's not what I'm seeing. I'm seeing a lot of people who are making this decision not based on science, not based on medical data, not based on a consultation with their doctor, but based on fear. And now they are using that fear to separate us. And now they're separating families. And that breaks my heart. The holiday season is a time when families would get together. And after a year of these ridiculous illegal lockdowns, after 2 years of separation, the opportunity to see family members, to have them be refused because you're not willing to be a medical experiment. Tell me that doesn't break your heart. It breaks mine. Now, you do what you do. The decision is yours. But I would simply ask you to consider this. Are you really in that much threat by those who are vaccinated or those who are unvaccinated? Since it appears to be the vaccinated that are pushing this, are you really under such dire threat? Not because Fauci said so or the CDC said so. Look at the CDC data. Talk to your, go over the CDC data with your doctor and ask, am I truly at risk? Look at the evidence that, guess what? You're just as likely to spread COVID as to get COVID. And ask yourself, is this how you want to live your life? Is this the legacy that you want to leave to your children and your grandchildren? A legacy of fear? A legacy of separation, of segregation? Of a tearing of family apart? Overtaking a shot that if you look at the evidence of 40%, it reduces your chances of getting COVID by 40%. If I can paraphrase a famous quote, he who lives by fear dies 1,000 deaths, but the brave man dies but once. Now, America Out Loud Talk Radio plays on the iHeartRadio Network, so you can listen 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on our media player or any of our apps for Apple, Android, or Alexa. And now you can listen to the podcast as well. So check out America Out Loud Talk Radio and spread the message of liberty.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends.